All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Calls and questions are starting to roll in, but if you press 1 on your phone right now, we'll get to, if you've got a question, a comment, a topic, anything at all you want to talk about, and you haven't pressed 1 on your phone yet, do it now, and we'll get to as many as we can today. We're going to get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your own authority, building a fleet, hiring drivers, you name it, we'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and ask the question. We're going to get to those questions in just a little bit. I was reading this morning about a prediction. I'm not always convinced that we get these predictions right, but things change. But early last year, crude oil was at about $110 a barrel. And currently it's at $40 a barrel. And there is a oversupply everywhere in the world, so much so that they are running out of places to store the oil. So they are now talking about predictions of $20 a barrel on oil. That would have a major impact on a lot of things. It hurts some things. Obviously, anybody in the oil industry, as we've already seen, is going to get further decimated by those kind of prices. I think, you know, good owner-operators who know how to manage fuel costs will be hurt by this. And it's hard to say what could happen to the economy itself. So we will just have to wait and see. But that would be a pretty major thing. And they're talking about the fact that that could last for a year or more. So something to keep an eye on. If you have any questions about that or anything else you want to talk about, we will get to your calls. In fact, let's go to them right now. Let's start off in Louisiana. Roy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. Just had two things. First, with a comment, you had a guy call the other day about an EcoPure. It wasn't seating properly and that it was leaking up around the rim. You know,
yeah.
I kind of wonder if he actually put the, when he put it on, before he put it on, did he wipe the top of it with oil, with clean oil, because they won't seat properly if you don't do that, you know, which will cause, and that used to always happen in cars and such. People would mount them and forgot to put the oil around the gasket so they wouldn't seat properly. They wouldn't marry up. But my question was.
That's a good point.
Go ahead.
Sometimes on filters and the O-rings, I even use a light grease instead of the oil.
Right.
The oil works, but sometimes I'll even put a light grease on there. If you do that, then the next time you got to make sure you clean that groove out first, then reapply some new clean grease. But you're right. That might have been what was going on.
Yeah. My question was, I had just put the EcoPure. I bought it in Dallas. Actually, I met you there, but at your seminar, but I bought the EcoPure and already told me where to go put it on down in Orlando, which was great, and it all worked out good. But here a couple of weeks ago, the vent line purged out a little bit of oil. Have you ever seen that happen?
Oh, boy, do I have a story about that. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again because it's kind of interesting. This goes way back. I ordered a new Freightliner. And one of the options was actually having the OPS installed while they were building the truck. And I thought, perfect. I'd love to have it done that way. You know, I'll get all the factory lines and connections. And so I ordered the truck. I'll cut this story short, but it was just as we were going into the first round of emissions back in 04. And I ordered the Mercedes engine for one reason only, because they were the last manufacturer that was still allowed to build pre-emission engines in 04 and the 05 model year. So I ordered a Mercedes. Didn't really want it, but I thought I'd rather have a non-emission Mercedes than an emission anything else. What happened, though, was every other fleet in the country was doing the same thing, and my order kept getting pushed back because of these big fleet orders. So a truck that I was supposed to get in November of 04, I didn't get until August of 05. I mean, it was just crazy what happened with that order. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was, because the order kept getting pushed back, they ran out of non-emission engines. So I ended up with an emission engine and a transmission I didn't order. Turned out to be one of the worst trucks I've ever owned. I hated that truck. But it had an OPS on it. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. The week that the truck finally got... Oh, and I was renting a truck all this time, because I had ordered this truck for a run. And when it didn't come in, I still had to cover the run. So I had to rent a truck all this time, which is really expensive. And the truck comes in the same week that I am leaving for a three-week trip to Alaska with no cell. I'm going to be in areas with no cell phone, no email, no nothing. And I had to decide, do I want to put a brand new truck on the road not being here, or do I want to keep renting a truck for three more weeks? And I made the decision to just put the truck on the road. I have good drivers. I have good mechanics. They'll take care of everything, even if they can't get a hold of me. So I leave. I come back 3 weeks later, and I find out that the truck was using, somewhere we were losing a gallon of oil every 250 miles. So every day, we had a 500 and some mile round trip run every day, and every day they had to put a gallon of oil in the morning, a gallon of oil at the halfway point, 2 gallons a day. So they had taken it over to Freightliner several times, and Freightliner couldn't figure out what the problem was, and they finally told me they were going to have to rebuild the engine. They were going to have to do an in-frame. And I said, I'm going to go look at this thing. Let me figure it out. I go over there. It took me about an hour to figure out what the problem was. The oil was blowing out of the blow-by at the bottom of the engine. So they thought somewhere internally we were losing all this oil, but they couldn't tell me what it was. Well, it turns out when they installed the EcoPure, they took the overflow line and they wrapped it with the blow-by tube. But it looked like with this factory wrap on it. So the oil wasn't coming out of the engine blow-by. The oil was coming out of the EcoPure overflow. And that was also their mistake, because they mounted it so low, you have to mount that unit so gravity takes the oil back into the engine. Well, they mounted it so that they had to run the return line under the frame and then back up. And the oil couldn't make it back into the engine, so it all just kept blowing out. All I did was turn off the EcoPure, send them on one trip. They came back, didn't use a drop of oil. So it can do that. If you have either not enough of a drop for gravity to take the oil back into the engine, or you have some sort of an obstruction, then the pressure will start blowing some oil out that overflow.
Okay. Well, you hadn't done it since. It just did it the one time, and I've been keeping an eye on it. And I just figured I'd raise that question. I was going to call Artie about it, but I said, well, I can always listen to your show. I'll just see if I can hit you up about it, see if you had ever heard it happen. But I appreciate that. That kind of explains, maybe.
Yeah, as long as we have good flow, I like to have about at least a 9-inch drop from where the oil exits the cure and where it enters the engine. I want to have about a 9-inch drop, and that keeps everything flowing nice. If you get a 4 or 5-inch drop, it'll still work. But once in a while, we will see some oil blow out the overflow. So take a look at that. Make sure, you know, the line isn't restricted in any way. And other than that, that's the only thing I've ever seen that would really cause that.
All right. Thanks for your input. I appreciate it. Enjoy your show.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Ohio. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking the call.
Oh, hey, I wasn't paying attention. Hold on. There's the music. I'm going to put you back on hold, but I'm going to come back to you right after the break, so stick around. If you need any help from us, our Tribe Care team is available to help you off the air. Grab something to write with. I'll give you the number, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-FUEL. 3835. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. I'm going to head off to Ohio. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I got caps on my truck right now, and I'm going to replace them probably in another couple of months. And I have a spare drive tire, which only has 2/32 worn off it, and it's a low oil resistance tire. Would I be bad to buy 7 more and match them up with that, or is that a bad choice?
What is the rolling resistance on that, the number?
104.
Oh, that's an excellent tire then. As long as that tire isn't more than 5 years old. Look at the manufacturer date on it.
Then
absolutely. Yeah, I would buy 7 and save yourself on one tire.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure because, you know, somebody told me, oh, it's going to mess it up. I thought, you always say that they wear pretty quick and it became, anyways, I thought it would even up fairly quickly.
Well, and even, you know, 2/32 difference isn't a big deal. If we get to 8/32 and then we try matching those two tires next to each other, at 8/32, you're going to run into a problem. At 2, you'll be fine, and you're right. That other tire is going to lose that first 2/32 pretty quick, and they'll even up.
All right, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Hey, I want to let you know about our text message system. We are doing a lot of recording off the air. We are doing a lot of podcasts. We're adding some new shows. Working on a new show right now that I'm really excited about with Bruce Mallinson and the electrical engineers over at Pittsburgh Power. We're going to do at least an hour a week with them, maybe two. That will probably depend on my schedule and if I can free up the time. But we are going to start doing an hour of engine and electrical-related questions only every week. So if you've got a question about power, about engines, about in-frames, rebuilding, fuel mileage, electrical and electronic issues, this is the show. So, and we have lots of other shows. We have our Destination Health show. We have our show Rolling Toe with Mike and Kevin Beckett, all about tires and alignment. We've got our show with Kenny Long about getting and operating with your own authority. We have Rico Muhammad, who does a show all about rates and lanes and what's going on there. Lots of great information, and the best way for you to find it is to get on our text message list. And that way, every time we're doing a show, we send you a text with the phone number. You hit the phone number, and you are listening to the show right on your phone, and you can always jump in and ask a question. And it is much easier to get through to these shows off the air. So grab your phone or grab something to write with, and I'll tell you how you get to be a part of this. Just like you would send a text message to anybody, open up your text message. Where you would put the phone number, you're going to put a short code. So the short code in the U.S. is 99,000. If you have a U.S.-based phone, put 99,000 in the phone number. If you have a Canadian-based phone, put 76,000. It's a new short code for Canada. And then in the body of the text, all you need to put in is one word, listen. That's it. Hit send. Wait about 30 seconds or so, you'll get a response, and you'll know that you are in our system. Now, just to let you know, if you're in the system and you want to stop the text for a while, when you get a text from us, just type the word stop and send it back, and you are automatically put on hold, and we won't send any more text until you send the word listen again. So you are totally in control. We don't spam you. We don't send you text you don't want, and you can stop at any time you want. So text the word listen to 99,000 in the U.S. and 76,000 in Canada. You'll be on our list, and every time we do a show, a recording, a special event, we will send you a text and let you know what's going on. Let's head off to Washington. Al, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Glad to be in part of your world.
Absolutely. What's on your mind today?
I got an oil sample there for you to take a look at.
All right. Let's see what we've got going on. Tell me a little bit about this engine.
It's a 04 C15. I've got about 1.2 million miles on it, 1.3 approximately, and it's about 650,000 since the overhaul. And a peculiar thing with this thing, it's a bridge motor, but I am bridged. It's got a nice program in the ECM. Before and after the overhaul, between 6 and 8,000 miles, it uses a gallon of oil. There's no leaks, no nothing. Runs like a top. It's a charm. But that's just something I learned to live with, which is one of the reasons why I went to the OPS.
And, so,
yeah.
So I'm looking at this. Let's talk about how the engine is performing first. We have no fuel dilution, no soot, viscosity is holding good. Is this a 30-weight oil?
Yes, it's that and probably different ways, because it's a smorgasbord. I put all whatever's on sale is what I buy, and I'll put it in from even synthetic. I'll throw that in, whatever's on sale.
Got it. So right now the viscosity is up a little bit at 14, but if you're mixing oils, that would probably explain that. Base and oxidation, nitration are all good. We are seeing some elevated iron. And I don't see any reason why we should have elevated iron, but it's been there for a long time, and it's really not going up. Trying to look back. So you haven't changed oil in about 103,000. The last three samples, it's all been 170 or so, right in that area. So it's not getting any worse, and what's in there will stay there. We can't get rid of it unless we change the oil. I don't see it as a problem because it's not increasing. I'm not sure why it was so high. It might have been part of the original in-frame. Sometimes we get a lot of wear metals. So there's nothing wrong with leaving this go just the way it is. There's nothing in this oil that's going to hurt anything. If it were me, it, just because it bugs me seeing it that high, even though it's not going up, I would probably do one oil change, and there's no hurry. You do it whenever you want. You get around to it. I would stop mixing so many oils. You know, all oils have to be compatible, but all oils act a little differently. And what I'm concerned about is when we see something weird like this, like a high iron for no reason, and then it stops, it's not getting any worse, it's really hard to pinpoint. Could the oils be causing this somehow, even though they're compatible? Every now and then we see engines react weird to different oils. And by having all the different oils in there, it's going to make it hard if something does go wrong. If you call me, you know, a month from now and we have a bunch of weird stuff going on in the sample and you tell me you're using all these different oils, the first thing I'm going to say is dump the oil, get one oil in here, let's do another sample and see what happens. Because that all those oils could just confuse some of the readings. So at some point, and again, no hurry, if it were me, I would change the oil, and then I would probably try to stick to the same brand. You know, the couple bucks you save on your makeup gallons because it's on sale, it really isn't worth all the confusion we might see in an oil sample.
Okay. I'll go ahead and do that. Yeah, I'm right about due for my service. I'll go ahead and do it, change the oil that way and follow the thing. I have a question regarding GI levels, the glycemic index.
Okay.
What is recommended for the, I'm pre-diabetic, so I hear, you know, you got to keep it under 100, but what is for the whole day? What is the amount that somebody should have for the whole day?
So first of all, I know a lot of people believe in the GI, the glycemic index. I don't. There are some real problems with it. The problems come in especially for diabetics, and that's who it was designed for. But the problem is something like fructose, which we know is one of the worst sugars for us, has a very, very low glycemic impact because it's not metabolized the way other sugars are. It's metabolized in your liver, so you don't necessarily get a blood sugar spike, but it's not good for you. Things like agave syrup, which they told us was supposed to be so healthy, is not. It's almost all fructose. So even though it won't give you that spike, your body still has to process a lot of sugar. So the glycemic index is really skewed for foods that are not really healthy, but they show up as a low glycemic index, and then people think, oh, this is a good thing for me to eat. It's not. So throw away the glycemic index. When we come back, I'll give you a much better way to measure, especially being pre-diabetic. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Al in Washington. So, Al, here's what I want you to do. First of all, the absolute best thing you can do is avoid all sugars and starches. And I'm just not sure why the groups like the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association, all these groups that give dietary advice, why they don't say that. Sugar and starch is not required in your body at all. We could have zero sugar and starch in our diet, and we could be perfectly healthy. So we know that prediabetes or diabetes is an issue of blood sugar control, and instead the American Diabetes Association says, eat whatever you want, just cover it with your medication. They should be disbanded, and the half of them should be put in jail for giving that kind of advice. Why not just give the advice, don't put the sugar in your body in the first place, and you won't need any drugs? I mean, that seems so simple, and you'll be much healthier. But let's not shoot for zero, but let's shoot for a really healthy level. And the way you're going to do that is get most of your calories from fat and a little bit of protein, because they have almost no impact at all on your blood sugar. When you are going to get carbs, try to get as many of them from vegetables as possible. When you are, if you're going to eat something that has a label, you want to look at the carbohydrates, and there's two parts. On the label, you're going to see total carbohydrates, then you're going to see fiber. What I want you to do is take the total carbohydrates and subtract the fiber, because your body can't digest the fiber, but it's good because your good gut bacteria can digest it, and we want that. So we don't count the fiber against your carbohydrates for the day, because we want the fiber. It's good that it's there. That's what's called net carbs. You take the total carbohydrates, subtract the fiber. Now, once you get down to your net carbs, if you are pre-diabetic, I would try for 2 weeks, and this is kind of jump-starting the program, I would really try hard for 2 weeks not to consume more than 20 net grams of carbs. And watch what happens to your weight, your blood sugar, your mood, everything. Now, you said pre-diabetic, so you're not on any kind of medication, right?
For high blood pressure, which I quit, the high blood pressure, triglycerides, cholesterol, and prostate, I quit about 6 months ago. I've been pretty good on the ketogenic diet. I read all the books you recommended.
Okay, good.
I've lost 35 pounds in about 3 months. The only thing is, I check my blood pressure. One time I checked it. I used to be pretty high, like 165 over 110. And I went down to like 137 over 88. But the other day I checked it, and it was after I had the bulletproof coffee, and it was about 155 over 100.
Yeah, and that's not unusual. There's one thing we know about blood pressure, and it's the same with blood sugar, that, you know, the mistake we've made on a lot of these things is the only time we check those two numbers for a lot of people is when they go to the doctor. And your blood pressure can be all over the board all day long. Exercise, hot showers, stress, all kinds of things. So what we like to do if we're concerned about those numbers is track them ourselves. And they're both easy to track. And then you'll see averages. And if my blood sugar or my blood pressure spikes once in a while, not a big deal. Yours has been coming down. Caffeine will raise blood pressure, but so will a lot of water. If you drink a lot of water and there's more water in your body at any given moment, that will raise blood pressure. So if you have if you have one of those days where you tend to eat more carbs, carbs require water to process, so it will make you thirstier. You'll drink the water, your blood pressure will shoot up. So lowering the carbs will not only lower your blood sugar, it will lower your blood pressure because your body won't need to hold on to as much water either. So you're on the right track. Just keep doing what you're doing and really focus on keeping that carb count low. And don't worry about the glycemic index. It'll just confuse you, and it will encourage you to eat foods that aren't really healthy. Let's see. We are going to head off to Michigan. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question as it relates to I have a question as it relates to profit gauges. I recently just got back in the owner-operator game back in August, and I started using profit gauges. And I have a question. I'm an established an LLC in my home state and have elected to be taxed as an S corp. And I've been paying myself a wage every week since I started. And I've been including those wages on profit gauges. Now, I know it says you're not, when you hover over the question mark there, it says not to. But I had called in before, and somebody told me that I should. So I'm just trying to clarify, should I or should I not?
Well,
I think
you
have
should,
that in front of you.
And, yeah, I do. I have your report, so we can go over that as well. We need to change that little tip that pops up when you hover over the question mark, because originally the program was designed just for sole proprietors. And as a sole proprietor, you would never put your wage in there. As an S-Corp, you would. We need to make that a little more clear. So you are doing it correct. The other thing you want to know is if, for comparison purposes, if you are listening to me read somebody else's report and I say that they're keeping, you know, 55 cents a mile on the bottom line, well, in order to get your correct number, you would add the bottom line net per mile plus your wages. In this case, you're showing 21 cents a mile profit, and you're showing 43 cents a mile as wage. So you are really keeping 64 cents a mile, which is excellent.
Okay, good. Good. Okay, I feel pretty good now. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call. And congratulations on keeping track of your numbers, getting right back into the game. And your numbers look good, and the accounting looks good. I scrolled through there. Everything looks like it's entered right, and that is excellent. Let's head off to Colorado. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? I just want to start off by saying you do your partner companies a great service. I just look at my truck and feel the way it's running right now, running real good. I've got the Fleet Air Filter, the Fast System, the EcoCure, air tabs, on my second set of Super Single Michelins. You know, I've got the tablet, and I've got your scan gauge. So I've got a good going here.
Thank you for being such a loyal tribe member. We love that.
Absolutely. And my questions now, I've got an oil sample, but I've got a stair tire. I've got Michelin Multi-Z, combination regional long-haul tire on. And they were doing great. We've got about 130,000 miles on them right now, somewhere right in there. And the driver's and the passenger side is starting to wear uneven. There are right on the outside rear, there's long elongated indentions in the rear. And it seems like the tire is starting to hop a little bit. I don't know if that's a balancing problem. I've got the Centromatic rings on there. I've got the centering sleeves. I don't have the beads in there, and I don't have the tire balance, so that's the problem over there.
Now, is this what wheel position is this?
This is the stair tire passenger side.
Okay, so
and it seems to start hopping. It seems to start hopping at 64, 65 miles an hour. If I'm doing 57, 60, it's smooth.
Okay, so that helps a lot. Now, you know, you said you had the Centromatic and not the Counteract, and that's fine. We don't ever want to use both. Feel like they might just fight against each other. And on steer tires, Centromatics are excellent. I used them for years and years and years. I switched to the Counteract for a couple reasons, and the Counteract really works better in wide singles than any of the balance rings ever did. On a steer tire, though, Centromatics work great. So leave those there. This is an alignment, and it sounds like probably a toe issue. You need to get that toe reset. You know, I would highly encourage you, and I'm going to come back to you right after the break, so stick around, to use an MD alignment shop if you get anywhere near well, you're not that far from Kansas City now. Stop in and see Chad at Alignment Solutions, and he will fix this in a heartbeat. And I would do it fairly soon because that's an expensive tire. Stick around. We'll come right back. We'll talk about your oil sample. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment. At the end, I'll say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff, but don't hang up because we're going to come back and do another hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm going to head back to Colorado. Michael, does that help you with the tire question?
Yes, I appreciate that. And one more quick question before we get to the oil sample about the Pittsburgh exhaust manifold as well. Will that affect the braking power of the engine brake at all? Seems like I have to downshift one more gear than I ordinarily have to coming down the mountains.
You know, it shouldn't, because in actuality, it should help the exhaust brake, the engine brake, work better. And the reason is that a lot of people don't understand how the engine brake works, so I'm just going to explain it real quick so people get an idea. If you have the Jake brake, let's be specific that we're talking about a Jake brake because there are different kinds of engine and exhaust brakes. If you have the Jake brake turned off and you let off the throttle, there's no fuel going into the cylinder, but as the piston comes up to the top, the exhaust valves are closed, and that creates pressure, and that pressure drives the piston back down even with no fuel. So it's not going to accelerate, but it's not going to decelerate a whole lot either, because we still have that compression pushing the piston back down. Now, when we open or turn on the Jake brake, now when the piston comes up, the exhaust valves will be open. So no pressure builds up in that cylinder, and there's no pressure to drive the piston back down. I'm going to put you back on hold because I'm getting a ton of background noise. You should still be able to hear me. So now on you could have a three-stage Jake brake. On stage one, only two cylinders will have the valves open. On stage two, four cylinders will, and on stage three, all six will open up. That's why we hear that loud exhaust noise, because we basically turn the engine into a giant compressor, and we're pumping the air out through the exhaust. So the better it flows, for example, with the exhaust manifold, the better that exhaust flows out of the engine, the less back pressure would be created, and the more powerful the engine brake should become. Now, engine brakes can wear out, so it might just be a matter of getting the engine brake rebuilt if it's starting to get weaker. Does that make sense?
Yes, sure.
All right, now on to your oil sample. It looks like, I want to verify some numbers, got 80,000 miles on the engine. That would be an in-frame, right?
Correct.
And 46,000 on this oil.
Yes.
The sample looks really good, except for one thing, and it's not a big deal, but
the base?
The fuel dilution, I would just totally ignore. The iron is low. I wouldn't worry about that at all. The base number, it's not a huge problem, but I would keep an eye on it. Sometimes some engines don't seem to get along all that well with some oils. Now, you're using a good oil. It's an oil I really like, the Schaefer Synthetic. Just keep an eye on this. And sometimes what we can do, there's two things we can do when the base starts dropping. We can drain a gallon of oil out and dump a gallon back in. That'll freshen it up. Or you can go to Lubrifiner and get their filters that have bass right in the filter. And you spin the filter on when you do a sample, and it keeps bass in the oil. Because bass is pretty simple. Bass is the same as an antacid that we would take. In fact, you could crush up an antacid, a Rolaids, and put it in your crankcase, and it would do the same thing. It's just there to neutralize acid. But as it neutralizes acid, it gets consumed. That's why it's one of those numbers that starts high, and when it gets too low, we have to get more in there somehow. And I've found that when we're doing extended drains, some oils will just consume that base. And I really found the best way to get it back in there is with that filter.
I got you. Okay, real good. I mean, yeah, freshening up the oil doesn't help at all?
Yeah, it will. Yeah, anytime you put in a new gallon, you're going to bring that base back up as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. What would be a base number that would be considered too low?
So it's a little tricky because we really want to know how much base the oil started with. Schaefer, let me try to remember. I think that oil starts with right around 10. And what we look for is if the oil drops below 25% of its original number, then we need to do something to get it back up. So as long as you were over about 2.5 on the base, you're fine.
I got you. Well, I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's see. We've got time for another call. Let's head off to Missouri. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. See, I had a girlfriend that's been on antidepressants and anxiety pills, when she went through her divorce, and now she's, like, dependent on them. And she's not really, is there a way to weed off of those, or do you go cold turkey, and does the keto diet help with whatever this is going on?
Okay, a couple of good questions. Let's take them in order. Do you happen to know which anti-anxiety she's on?
No, I don't.
Okay, a lot of them act the same. They are basically what are referred to as SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So they're all a little different, but they all do basically the same thing. Now, the interesting thing to me is that doctors that prescribe these don't tell people how hard they are to get back off of. They are, if you go look this up on the internet, you will find absolute horror stories of what people go through trying to get off of these. I would not recommend going cold turkey because it's kind of brutal. What I would recommend is that she just keeps stepping the dose down. Whatever dose she's on, start decreasing the dose. And if she decreases it and gets some really bad symptoms, you can get nausea, headaches, the anxiety can start to come back. If you get those, then you've got to go slower. So, and right now we're talking about with no change in diet. If you just wanted to get off the medication, the slower you do it, the easier it's going to be. If you're just really into pain and suffering, you could do it cold turkey, and it'll probably take 3 or 4 days. But those 3 or 4 days, from what I understand, can just be miserable.
Yeah, what she did is she went cold turkey. She said she made it 2 days, and she was just an emotional wreck. She had to start taking them again. And from what I understand, she's not on huge doses or whatever, but she wants to get off of them, but she said she's afraid to go through what she went through, and she just went cold turkey.
Well, so she is seeing exactly what I just said. You know, it takes about 4 days, and it's misery. I mean, it is just horrible. Most people give up. Stepping down the dose over, even if it takes her, 3 months to where she just steps down a little bit and you start cutting pills in half or in a quarter and, step the dose down slowly, and that will make this much easier. And then at some point, you got to go, completely off. And no matter how small the dose is at the end, She's going to suffer some side effects for a day or two, but it won't be nearly as bad as what she just tried to go through. Now, the good news, if she goes full-blown ketogenic, and if that's the only way I would recommend even trying it. If she goes part of the way, she's probably not going to see any results, and she's going to make herself even more miserable. What I would recommend doing is I would recommend if she's willing and she really wants to get off this and she wants to get rid of the anxiety forever, there is a tremendous amount of evidence that the ketogenic diet will do that. And I would go into all the explanations, but I don't have enough time. I would recommend that right now she stays on her current dose and does 2 weeks of a ketogenic kickstart. And you can look it up on the internet. Basically, all she's going to do is keep her carbs down under 20 grams a day, which is really low, for about 2 weeks. And once she gets through some of those side effects, she's going to feel a lot better. And then stepping off the anxiety medication is going to be a breeze.
Okay. Yeah, she was following what I was doing on the keto diet stuff, and she lost, like, 15 pounds, and she was feeling great. And then, of course, she went back to her addiction with Pepsi.
Well, and believe it or not, believe it or not, there is a very, very strong link between the high carb and sugar intake and the anxiety. So she can cure the anxiety without the drug. I would do this in a two-step process, though. Trying to go full-blown keto and go off the anti-anxiety would be kind of rough. There's the music. I'm all out of time. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to do another hour. Let me check on questions here real quick. Looks like we're loaded with questions, so I'm just going to get right to it. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call. We'll discuss it here on the air. I'm going to get to those calls in just a couple minutes. I want to let you know that planning for the 2016 CMC is moving at a very rapid pace, full steam ahead. Registration is open, and I'm going to give you some details on that, so grab something to write with. This really is the owner-operator event of the year. There's nothing else like this program. We started this program 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago. It started as a two-day program with 15 or 20 people in the room, and it is now a full-blown five-day business conference, and we are shooting for 500 people in the room this year. The last 3 years, we've been completely sold out, and we've had waiting lists, so we have expanded the event. We've been in Kansas City for the last 7 years, but we had to move because we needed more room. And now that we have more room, we are able to take the event even higher to the next level. We have so many exciting things going on. Bruce Mallinson is going to be building a signature engine during the event. His crew will be doing it. Bruce is one of our speakers there as well. We have Mike Beckett, who will be doing all of his stuff on alignment and tire wear. George Gallimore is coming back to do sales and negotiating. Larry Winget, six-time best-selling author and one of the top speakers in the world right now, is coming back again to be our keynote speaker. Larry, I absolutely loves this event, by the way. Larry has spoken all over the world, and this is what he's been doing for 20-plus years. If you take the Fortune 500 companies, which are the biggest 500 companies in the nation, Larry has spoken to over 400 of them. Larry gets paid very well for what he does. But after speaking at all those companies and all those other industries and all over the world, Larry tells me his favorite event is our CMC. He loves the people. He loves. He hangs out with us there. He signs books. Just always a great time. And Larry has committed to coming back as long as we will have him. We are looking to add some other speakers as well. I'll be doing a lot of speaking, obviously. We have new events this year. So much going on. In fact, I don't have time to even come close to telling you about it all. But if you have any questions, you can call us, and we can get you signed up. We have a payment plan. Makes it very, very easy. It'll cost you less than $100 to get registered. So two ways. You can go to the website. If you don't have any questions at all and you just want to get registered, go right to the website, letstruck.com. Look under the events tab, and you can sign up right there. If you have questions, give us a call. We'll answer all your questions, then we'll get you signed up. It's 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3535. We're going to get started on calls. We're going to head off to Louisiana. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Kevin.
Good afternoon. What's on your mind today?
I was able to get over. I heard what the guy said about the possible putting the oil on the filter thing, and well, I took the new filter over to David's, but I did the same thing I did last time, which was dump the old oil into the new one, so I got all the oil all over the place again. So who knows? I'll have to figure that one out. But
okay.
I'm probably did the same dumb thing. We'll figure it out. But I took the truck over to David over there, Fleet Air Filter, and he cut out the inside of the area where I get my air from. He cut the fiberglass on it, and we opened up, we measured all the little pieces of fiberglass. We opened up 14 inches of air going into that was obstructed on the way that the hood's built.
Excellent. That should make a difference.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see. This is I'm filling up right now for the first. The other question, which I keep forgetting to ask you, is on the flow below. I know that I talked to Matt about it, and he had texted somebody on your staff there. But I have the 2-inch offsets, but they're flipped around. So, you know, if I'm going to be doing the flow below, I'm going to have to figure out a different bracket system or something.
Well, you would order the flow below for the zero offset.
But my hub sticks out further than the rim.
Oh, you mean for the wheel cover?
Yeah, for the wheel covers. Yeah.
Got it. So okay, the hub itself with no hubcap or anything else on it is further out than the edge of the rim.
Correct.
Have you talked to Flow Below directly?
No, but I talked to Matt talked to one of your people on your team, and they said that they only make it for the, you know, you'd have to build it specially. I didn't talk to Flow Below myself. I was, you know, Matt had called somebody for me checked with somebody.
It's not that I don't trust our team. It's just an unusual question. Yeah, I trust them completely. It's just an unusual question that I would check with Flow Below directly because they may have a solution for you.
Okay, I will give them a call. Can you ask Lisa to pick up the phone for me when you put me on hold?
I will do that. Let's go to Colorado. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. I'll be quite honest. I was raised one way to maintain the vehicle, and I got a feeling, having listened to your show even for a week, that you agree with me. And that's basically, it's cheaper to maintain the vehicle than to repair one.
Absolutely. Not only cheaper, but a lot less frustrating, too.
Yeah, well, 2 days ago, I spent 5 hours on I-80 between Laramie and Cheyenne on the crest because I lost my radiator. And my boss is frustrating. He's throwing Band-Aids at things. He called Road Squad after calling a tow truck, thinking that Road Squad could just put a makeshift plug in my radiator where I lost the plug and send me on my merry little way.
Not very likely.
No. I sat there 5 hours before a tow truck finally came to get me, at which point the road was already closed. When I got on the road, it was still open, but they closed it for especially high profile vehicles like myself.
Right.
Luckily, I was hauling paint, so I was at 77,000. What do I do? I mean, he's throwing Band-Aids at major items.
Okay.
I mean,
so,
he actually told the shop. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to give you two options, and you may not be happy with my answer, but this is just the reality. Your only two options really are quit or stay and put up with it. And here's the reason why I say that. I completely agree with you. I think this is a horrible way to run a business. If you own a truck and that truck is what provides the revenue and gets the job done, you maintain it. It's much easier on everybody. It's cheaper in the long run. Two things cause people to do this. Either they just don't understand mechanics at all, mechanical issues, or they're always broke. They're just always so short on cash flow that they just keep doing just enough to get by. So sometimes it's a combination of both. So I agree with you. I couldn't work like this. So if this were me in this position, I would have to take option A and I would have to quit. The reason I give you option B is because if you don't want to quit, you just need to put up with it and ignore it and deal with it. And the reason I say that is because it's next to impossible to change somebody else. And when people call the show and they want me to help them figure out how to change somebody else, I don't have any answers. I don't know how to do that. I'm going to put you on hold, but I'm going to come back to you after the break, so don't go away. It's just really, really difficult to ever change anybody else. He knows what he's doing. Pointing it out to him probably isn't going to do much good. So the decision really comes down to what do you want to do, not how do we get him to do something different. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. If you need any help from us off the air, our Tribe Care team is there. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give them a call. That number is 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. I'm going to get back to Colorado. Bill, I know that's probably not the answer you were hoping for, but does that make sense?
Yeah, I fully understand. There's nothing I can do to change him. I just have to be able to deal with it somehow. I mean, I was on the phone in the shop, or in the shop when the shop was on the phone with somebody that turned out to be my boss. The boss did not want to replace the radiator. He did not want to replace the water pump.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a lot of people like this, and I can tell you, again, I would have to take option A. I couldn't meditate enough to be able to get over this day after day after day. And the odds are it will get worse, not better.
Well, for 6 months, I have to take option B to remediate my first year of driving.
Got it. Okay. And that's why I wanted to give you two options, because sometimes quitting isn't a good option. And in that case, I believe it or not, I would recommend meditation. You need something to counteract the stress that this is going to cause. And the other thing is, every time it happens, instead of focusing on what's happening at the moment, which would frustrate all of us, focus on why you had to choose option B for now and work on a plan for the future. So every time that, you know, if this thing breaks down and you're sitting there, instead of, you know, getting all crazy because we know he's not going to do the right thing, instead, I would take that time and I would start working on your plans and goals for the future.
Absolutely. Next paycheck, I'm getting a PSP. I'm also getting with a agent for truckers and go from there.
What the agent for truckers, what does that mean?
There's a company on XM Radio that advertises as being a trucker's agent, like a football player's agent, except they specialize in truckers.
Oh, so they're like a placement agency. They're gonna take your background and your qualifications and go place you with the company.
Absolutely.
Got it. Okay. Got it. All right. Well, those are the kind of things you want to do. You want to stay as positive as you can. You want to control the things you can control and think about the things you can control and don't think about the things you can't control.
Sometimes it's hard, especially when you're sitting for 5 hours on a hill.
Oh, it's always hard. There's no question about it. It's always hard, but the best things in life are always hard.
Yeah. At least I can call myself a trucker.
And there you go. Because if we take the easy way out, and believe it or not, getting mad, getting upset about this, getting frustrated is actually the easy way out. It's much easier to get mad at somebody else and just focus on it because it takes all the burden off of us. This isn't my fault. This is his fault. He's the idiot. He's the one who doesn't know what he's doing. That's the easy way out. But it's also a very unhealthy way out. Doing the hard work, when you hear me say that at the end of every show, doing the hard work, this is a great example. The easy way is just to get pissed off at him every time it happens. That's what most people would do. And they would justify it in their own mind. Well, of course I'm pissed off at him. He's an idiot. But that's the easy way out. The hard way is to say, wait a minute. I'm here because of the things I have chosen in the past, because of my driving record or my lack of experience or whatever it is. It's much, much more difficult to take responsibility and say, I'm in this position because of the decisions I have made up until this point. I am going to start making better decisions. I'm not going to waste my time and energy getting mad at him. I'm going to do everything I can do so that I don't end up in situations like this in the future. That's the hard work. The easy way is just to get pissed off. Let's go to Ohio. Victor, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks again for taking my call and for all you do for us.
You're welcome. What can I help you with today?
I was in a lease operator program, and I got the hell out of there. What I'd like to do is go buy a glider from Schneider, because I don't think I'm in a position to go buy a new glider. In fact, I had a hard time getting financing on the glider at all, because a lot of these institutions, they think it's a high-risk vehicle, so they're asking for more down payment and blah, blah, blah. But I got my financing set up, so I'm going ahead and approved to go ahead and buy one. My problem is I don't know much in the way of mechanics. And for all the years I spent as a company driver, all you do is you pick up the phone, you call the company, they take care of it. So despite having your program, I really don't know how to evaluate a truck. How do I pick among them? Is there someone you could recommend to me in the St. Louis area that I could take along to evaluate the truck?
I just don't know that many people around the country and the people that I do know are so good at what they do. They're so busy doing what they do. They're not going to go do, you know, stuff like this.
St.
Louis?
No, but there's a number of those gliders at their St. Louis location, so I was going to go ahead out there. And, you know, other than doing a good free trip, I can't read ECM codes. And like I said, I would just be taking their rules for test driving the truck is on the yard only, so I can't even get it up to road speed. Would that be a red flag for you, and should I look elsewhere? I don't know where else to find used gliders.
What's the price on this truck?
They're a little under $60,000. And I'm looking at units
Let me take a step back. Let's say we're back in the year 2003, and there's no such thing as EGR and ACERT and all that other stuff that we hate. If I were going to go spend $50,000 on a truck and I couldn't test drive it off the lot, that would be an absolute no-go. I would say, no way, I'm not buying it. There's too many trucks out there, I could go find them. But we're not in 2003. We're in 2015, and used gliders, to me, are one of the best values on the market right now. So
I've come to that perspective.
Yeah, so I will overlook some things. I will take a little more risk. And honestly, I will tell you, there is not a huge risk here. The vast majority of these trucks are never going to be a big enough problem that they're going to put you out of business. Sure, there might be one on the line that's better than all the rest. There might be one on the line that is the worst. But I promise you, I could take the worst truck in that line, and I could go make money with it. It wouldn't scare me to have the worst truck out of the bunch.
So basically, as long as I run a rig dig and make sure it hasn't been in a rollover event or it had a really bad series of drivers that they had to fire for being put out of, getting put out of service more due to maintenance, right? And then Schneider's not going to.
Yeah. So do the rig dig. That's an absolute, a no-brainer. Now, here's what I would do. If I were in your shoes, I would go to St. Louis. I would find – this has a Detroit in them, all the Schneiders did. I would go to the Detroit garage, and I would make a friend over there with somebody. I would hang out. I would talk to the service manager. I would ask him, you know, if he has any techs that like to make a little money on the side. And I would pay somebody $100 an hour to come over and look at the truck with me and bring their laptop and their reader. Now, you might have to do it through Detroit. They may say, well, you know, our techs will work through us. They're probably going to charge you $120 an hour, whatever it comes out to. But it would be worth it.
Right.
Take one of those. You know, the rest of the truck I don't even care much about. There's nothing else on the truck that's going to cause us huge headaches that we couldn't fix at a reasonable price. So we're mostly concerned, is there any big red flags in the engine? And a good Detroit tech, it's only going to take him an hour anyway to go over and run a couple quick tests, pull up some things on the ECM, and tell you what he knows.
Okay, great. I was actually looking at Clark Power Systems, and they said they wanted 2 hours charge plus road service to come off site. But if I can negotiate with them on the side, maybe do it under the table, that'd be great too.
I would try that. If for some reason you can't find somebody that can do it, you know, on the side, I would pay the 2 hours in the road call. It's nice peace of mind. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Ohio. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got two of them for you today.
Sure.
The first one, iPhone. I have the 4S, which I know I've had it over 3 years, but it still works. I'm on Verizon. But now with my job, I need to use a mobile application for doing part of my job. And this daggone thing will not let me do it if I'm on an active telephone call. And I wonder, would iPhone above 4S, 5, 6, what have you, allow you to do that?
No. It's surprising how different the iPhone is on the different carrier systems. And I'm very familiar with this because when the iPhone first came out, it was AT&T only. And
right.
I hated AT&T's service. And I got so used to the way the phone worked, I couldn't wait till Verizon finally got the iPhone. The day they got it, I ran out and switched, and I found out all the differences. Let me give you one example. On an AT&T iPhone, I can conference in five other people on my call really easily, and I can drop any one of them at any time, and the phone call keeps going. On Verizon, I can't do that. If you get two people on the call with you and you want to drop one, you got to drop the whole call and then call somebody back. Major pain in the ass when you use your iPhone as your primary business phone. The other big downside on Verizon, you can't use data when you're on a phone call. And if you're using data and a phone call comes in, it bumps you offline. And if you're in the middle of something important, it can be really frustrating. So it's not the phone, it's the carrier. So if you want to be able to use an iPhone with data and calls and all those other features, you got to switch to AT&T. Now, the good news is AT&T's network has gotten much, much better over the last couple of years.
Okay, interesting. I don't have a contract anymore, so maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, we try to keep both in the company now. And when I travel, I try to have – there are some reasons I like Verizon, mostly because their network is still stronger in some areas. So we've got both, and that's the reason I know how all this works.
Okay, my second one. The other day on the – health show, you were talking about a couple of people in a rowboat that was even eating mega amounts of calorie. And during that talk, you mentioned that 3,000 would be a good number for somebody out here just doing what we do, driving a truck. And that just rang a bell. I thought, now, wait a minute. I'm not really losing anything here. I'm screwing it up someplace, but by doing tracking with I use the one that's called Lose It, I hit between 800 and 1,500 for the entire day. Is that maybe where I'm messing up?
It's possible. Now, let me clarify that number. I probably shouldn't have said 3,000. 2,500 is the recommended for an adult male. But we've also learned a lot that calories in and calories out doesn't really work the way we always thought it did. I said 3,000 because I know we have a lot of big eaters as far as truck drivers
sure.
go, and I didn't want anybody to freak out if I said 2,000. So 3,000 for somebody who's sedentary, sitting in a seat for 11 or 12 hours a day, is probably too much. You may be a little on the low side, though. And being on the low side actually can cause your body to retain some weight. And the reason it does is your body is designed to maintain. Yeah. Yeah, your body is designed to maintain. And we have a pretty strong survival instinct that if your body notices a low calorie intake, what it does is it starts to slow down a lot of other processes in your body, things we don't even realize are happening. You might have less energy, but you also may not be repairing damaged tissue and cells as well as you should be. Your body will turn down a lot of functions to save energy if it thinks that the calorie intake is too low. So you may want to try eating a little more. Now, the thing about being on a keto diet, though, is we really want our appetite to dictate what we eat. If we're not hungry, we shouldn't eat. So if you're really following your appetite, you're eating when you're hungry and you eat until you're satisfied, and you're only consuming 1,800 calories, it could be that that's all you need.
Well, I literally never, ever feel hungry anymore, ever, for at least a year. You know, the growl, everybody says, oh, I'm starving, my belly's growling. I haven't done that in well over a year. And the
yeah.
only time I really think that I need something is I get a funny feeling in my head. And so that's why I end up between 800 and 1,500 is just because, you know, I don't want anything.
Yeah, so you said you were tracking it. Do you happen to have the breakdown, like what percentage of your calories is coming from fat, protein, and carbs?
I typically end up in the 70 range for the fat. The carb stays in the neighborhood of 15 to 18, and the remaining is protein.
That's a great – I mean, you have got a really good balance, and, you know, it sounds like you're following your appetite. The calorie count does seem low. How active are you in any given day?
Well, that's a thing. I do railroad containers, so I do some drop and hook and in and out. You know what that's like. I do need to kick that up. I know that. I just started a new multivitamin, and I know you're not a big fan, but the one that I started, it actually has 100% of your daily iodine in it. And
okay.
Wow, I feel like I could just strangle a bear and stab him now in comparison.
Oh,
so maybe
good.
That part of it and iodine deficiency was part of it. I don't know yet.
It's very possible. A lot of people in the country are iodine deficient, but especially if you go off all the junk table salt that's in processed foods and you don't use the regular salt shaker at the table, you're using sea salt, because in regular table salt they put in iodine because it's so hard to get in our diet. When you go keto and you're using sea salt, go ahead.
I do use sea salt, but I can't find Himalayan pink to save my life. I don't know where to find it.
Actually, you can find it at Costco in a big grinder. It's kind of cool. You just buy it. It's right in a grinder, so you grind it fresh on your food. Don't worry about it. I mean, pink Himalayan is really good. It's supposed to be the cleanest salt on the planet. But if you can find any kind of sea salt, all sea salt has minerals in it, and that's really what we're looking for. We just don't want that garbage table salt where they've processed it, run a bunch of chemicals through it, stripped out all the minerals, and then they put the iodine back in. But we do need to make sure we're getting iodine from somewhere. If you're eating enough seafood, there's another thing you can try. If you can find a good health food store, they'll have it. If not, I just ordered a big bag of it online. And it's actually seaweed flakes. So it's like a dried flaked seaweed, and you would use it the way you would use salt. It's kind of salty, and it's got the flavor that they describe as umami. Umami is like the fifth flavor that gives food a depth. You know, in Chinese food or in a lot of Oriental foods, they get it from monosodium glutamate. We know we don't want that. You'll get the same type of depth of flavor from these seaweed flakes, and they are absolutely loaded with iodine. So I would rather see you try something like that. But in the meantime, keep doing the multivitamin with the iodine because it sounds like it is helping you.
Okay. Okay. Where would I get a suggested meal plan that I could just recycle if it was only 3 days worth, and then on day four, I'll go back to day one, that is a keto plan and the correct calorie amount, just because I think that I'm messing up what I choose, and I wondered if that maybe would help too.
It couldn't hurt. And the easiest thing to do is just Google keto diet plan, because I find that kind of information everywhere. It's becoming much more popular, and there are lots of sites now where I've found that kind of information free. So check that out. I think you're doing a good job. I really think that the key for you to kind of jumpstart your weight loss again is activity. I think you've got the diet down, and diet is the biggest part, but a little bit of intense activity a couple times a week can really jumpstart the process. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Texas. Adam, welcome to the program.
Afternoon, Kevin. I got a couple of quick questions for you. I have a 2010 ProStar ISX, and I've heard you talk about replacing fuel lines after around 700,000. I have the plastic fuel lines, and do you still recommend that, and why?
Okay, and that's a good question, because a year ago I would have said no, the plastic lines are just fine. The rubber lines will actually deteriorate on the inside. They'll look perfect on the outside, but all the fuel going through them over all the years will deteriorate them on the inside. That's why we replace them. But I was working with Brad Extem. He's the owner over at Fast Fuel Systems, and he knows more about fuel systems than anybody I've ever met. And he was telling me that the plastic lines will develop hairline cracks after they've aged, and you can't really see them, but they're enough that the fuel system starts sucking air. So now we are recommending replacing both plastic and rubber lines.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay. My second question is, I have this weird howling, whistling sound. And it's definitely there with throttle response. It's an air intake, and it's the loudest at 55 to 60 miles an hour. And it sounds like it's coming from the driver's side. Now, I've had it checked out a few times at my international shop, and the last time I was in there, they did that smoke test where they put it under pressure, ran smoke through there, and they cannot find it. Whatever kind of test they run, they cannot find it, and it's loud when it does it.
Now, when you say they do a smoke test, were you standing there? Do you know how they did it?
No, I was not there, but it's my main shop. I'm pretty close with them, and I know they put it under pressure, and they put the smoke in there, and they had to hook up some kind of machine. They said it takes a little while to hook up the machine, and they couldn't find anything.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is we kind of developed the idea of using the smoke machine to test the charger, cooler, and intake system, and I haven't found a shop anywhere in the country yet that's doing it. So it's interesting that you've got a shop that can do that. And if they did it right, then they have eliminated the intake system. I mean, the way we do it, just so you know, is we take the what was always referred to as the ether plug on the intake port. It's a quarter-inch plug. You unscrew that. We plug the smoke machine right into the intake manifold, and then we take the cover off the air cleaners, put a garbage bag around the air cleaners, and stick it back in, and that seals off the intake side. Then you start the smoke machine, and that fills up the entire intake system, charger, cooler, turbo, everything. And you find a leak. If there's a leak in the system, the smoke comes out. If they've done that and there's no smoke, then this sound is not coming from the intake system. You said that it was throttle dependent, like the more throttle you give it, the louder the noise becomes?
Yeah, definitely. Like, for example, like when I was going through Pennsylvania and they got all them cement, like retaining walls in the middle there for construction, and when I'm driving alongside one of them and I'm doing 60, I got my window down, and I get on the throttle, I mean, it's almost deafening coming in my left ear. And I let off the throttle, and it goes away. You get on the throttle, and it's right there.
Now, I'm thinking, now even when we have intake leaks usually don't create noises. And if you think about it, it makes some logical sense. When it's sucking the air into something, any noise that it might make would tend to be more muffled. What does make the noise you're talking about is an exhaust leak.
Okay.
Uh-oh. Oh, you there? Yeah, so I would be looking
at there.
Exhaust manifold. I would be looking at exhaust manifold, the exhaust side of the turbo. Those are the more common places.
Too, Kevin. Yeah,
replaced. That might be why they didn't get it back together right.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
I just wanted to kind of see what your thoughts were.
Yeah, a noise that loud, the odds are about 10-1 that it's exhaust, not intake.
Okay. All right, well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Salt Lake City. Ben, welcome to the program.
Sorry, hold on a second. I'll be right back. Hello?
Yep, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a 2000 Volvo with an N14, and for the past month, it's been running rough. And it tries to cut off. If I take my foot off the throttle, it will cut off. At some point, it has. And as this is happening, smoke comes out the smokestacks. I've taken it to three places for this, Volvo, Cummins, and TA, and nobody's fixed it. But, however, put a temporary relief on it. It didn't happen for a couple weeks, and then gradually it started happening again. And I have no
what idea. What was the temporary relief? What did they do?
They told me they got under there. They cleaned off some of the stuff off the batteries. Some of the connections were kind of dirty. They were kind of dirty or whatever. And then it stopped it temporarily until it started happening again.
Okay, so that's a little odd. I mean, if your battery connections are that bad, the truck wouldn't start. Once the truck is running, the batteries have a lot less to do with anything. Now, it's possible that we've got a bad connection between the battery and the ECM. So that's a different, so they may have been in there trying to clean up the main cables, and they made a little difference in the wires that go directly to the ECM. So I would recheck that. So I would start at the battery. I would find the wires that go directly to the ECM, and I would test voltage at both ends. So you get a multimeter, we test voltage right at the battery with the truck turned off, and then we go check at the ECM. And if we have a voltage drop more than about a half a volt or so, it's probably a good indication we've got a bad connection, a bad wire. That may be part of this. Boy, it wouldn't have been the first place I would have looked based on what you're telling me. But since they did something there and it made it better, it makes me wonder. Now, do you also, have you noticed any loss of power at the top end? When you're really on a hard pull, have you noticed that the power's dropped off?
No, actually, this happens in spurts. If I'm running, if I have a light load, it climbs hills fine. The disc is unpredictable. What? It could happen at any time. And I know you're not a fan of additives. I'm sorry?
You could dump some injector cleaner in this and see if that clears things up. Are you taking oil samples at all?
I haven't took one yet. I've had this truck a couple months.
I would take an oil sample. An oil sample will, for $50, it's going to tell us a lot more than paying a mechanic another $120 an hour to have him tell you nothing. The oil sample may not solve the problem, but many times it points us in the right direction. Do you have a pyrometer and a boost gauge on this truck?
No, I haven't. I've gone on your website. I've tried to enter in your profit and fuel gauges.
That's different. I'm trying to figure out, we can use a pyrometer and the boost gauge, those two gauges, to really troubleshoot a lot of things. Pyrometer will tell us a lot about how much fuel flow we're getting, and a boost gauge will tell us how much boost, how much pressure we're getting out of the turbo. And if either of those two things change, that helps point us in the right direction. It sounds to me like right now you're not very in tune with what's going on in the truck yourself, and that makes it much harder for a mechanic to figure out what's going on, even a good mechanic. It doesn't sound like you've had the best yet. I would skip Volvo and TA completely. I would go back to Cummins or to a good independent shop. I guarantee you, if you could get this to Pittsburgh Power, they would solve the problem in about 2 hours. Otherwise, get a scan gauge on here, and let's get some boost pressure and pyrometer readings and an oil sample, and I might be able to help you on another call. Right now, I'm all out of time. We'll see you back here next show. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right. Thanks, everybody. And next week, we're going back to our normal schedule, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday recordings. And we'll see you here over the weekend for the live show. Thanks.